It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. About 4 million years ago, our ancestors were just beginning to walk upright. At the same time, the ancestors of modern-day foxes were running around. 12 years ago, geologist Mark Matheson of Iowa State University uncovered a fossil of one of these ancient foxes, and now the species has been named after him. It's Vulpes Mathesoni, or Matheson's fox, and Mark is here with me today. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
For non-geologists, put this kind of honor in perspective for us. This seems like a very special thing to have a species named after you.
Oh, definitely. It's something I was very surprised by, like, finding, and they said, oh, if it's something new, we'll name it after you. But, you know, 12 years had passed, and I thought that was all kind of, you know, forgotten. But usually it's fossils like this are named after towns or various other things. They're, for people, they definitely want to make sure somebody's given a contribution to paleontology or on some way or numerous years to, you know, kind of bestow that honor on
you have
them.
You have to earn it beyond even just finding the species.
Definitely. Yeah, there's usually you have a lot of graduate students out with you and they're picking them up, but then a lot of times they won't. It's like, well, you need to earn your right a little bit more before we just give out names on that, especially with a lot of times with invertebrate fossils. Usually there's a number of those that are identified and found. But as you move up to the higher organisms or vertebrate fossils, usually those are a little more sought after or harder to, you know, actually earn the name.
So how did you find out? When did you get notified?
I found out this summer, got an email from John Flegel. He's from Stony Brook, and he was leading the expedition, and he emailed me and sent me a proof of the journal article describing the new fossil and saying, you know, congratulations, now you're immortal. So, so it was just like a complete shock, especially, you know, I had asked him a few years ago if it had been described or not, and he said, no, we're still trying to get people out there. So I've kind of written that off. I thought that was... Yeah, that it was just sitting in a box and in the museum at Addis Ababa, just collecting dust, and probably would be for, you know, the next century. So, but yeah, it was very surprising to get that. It's just like, yeah, to take a step back from the computer and realize the scope of it. So,
wow. Well, let's go back 12 years to your excursion to Ethiopia in 2003. What were you looking for when you went there?
Originally, we were kind of twofold things. With the geology, I was helping map out the stratigraphic units, or you'd kind of make it analogous to a layer cake where you're mapping out those units as they're deposited. And then also we were looking for pumice so we could age date these units. And also when you're out doing these things, you're just always looking for fossils. And there was another group that was working on one of the Leakey sites. They had found
Lewis Leakey.
Yes, Lewis Leakey. They had found a humanoid skeleton there, and we were trying to recover more of it by sieving down the hill, scooping up the sediments, and then sieving them, looking for more parts of that skeleton that had been found there. So, but you always, when you're walking around like that, looking for doing your other jobs, you're always keeping your eye out for fossils.
And how long were you in Ethiopia for this excursion?
It's a little over a month. So.
And this is obviously you were looking for primitive fossils, but you were really in the wilderness. Describe where you were for us.
We were down in the Omo River, almost as far south in Ethiopia as you can get without being in Kenya. To get there, you either could fly in more to like a dirt strip, and then you still had a two-day drive, four-wheeling, to get to the site. Or if you came from Addis Ababa, which we did, it was a four-day drive of four-wheeling and camping along the way. So you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Everybody's very more, I hate to say primitive, but more tribal on there, that, you know, subsistence living on that, you know, raising cattle. But, you know, that's kind of your lifeblood there. It's in an area, like if somebody gets injured or hurt, if it's serious, you're in a lot of trouble.
Well, and did you have a difficult time communicating with the locals? I know that there are many, many different tribal languages still spoken in Ethiopia. Could you communicate with people?
A little bit. A lot of times you could, you know, gesture or kind of, you know, get points across to people. But we did have a group from Ethiopia with us from their survey that spoke a number of the languages that we're able to translate and help out on that. So,
when did you actually find this fossil? Do you remember the moment?
Yes. It was a day where we were kind of broke off and we decided to try to do just more reconnaissance and try to collect more fossils around the area, just give a good blanking of the area. This was one of the last times they were on their permit that they were going to be able to work in the area. So they were trying to make sure they'd, investigate as much area as they could. But we had crossed the Omo River and gotten into Mersey territory. And at the beginning, we were followed by a couple Mersey that were, they're kind of wondering what we're doing, but we were trying to lose them because a lot of times they'll see what we're doing and then they'll try to imitate us or pick up the fossils too, but then you lose provenance and then the fossils are useless.
Okay, so you're talking about locals looking for fossils. I can understand that would be appealing because then you could probably sell them. You're saying that if somebody else picks up the fossil, then you don't know where it came from, so you can't research it. Is that the problem?
Exactly. Yeah. You've lost where it was found, what units, so trying to date it. And it, at that point, a lot of times they bring them in and try to sell them to us, but the director of there, he just take them and throw them away. It's like they're worthless to us. So, but that's where a lot of times we try to educate them to say, hey, if you find something interesting, just leave it there and then bring us to it and we can look at it and then properly document the find.
So, okay. But, all right. So you're trying to be on your own. What happened?
Yeah. Fortunately, there was other groups. They decided there were four of us and two of us broke off and were able to lose these guys. And then we were able to have some time to kind of really focus on what we were doing. And I was kind of off by myself in a little stream valley, noticed some white over to the side. So I got closer and it was kind of hidden in a bunch of brambly bushes. But that's the thing you notice in Ethiopia is every tree, everything has thorns. So you learn quickly, don't brush up against the trees or anything like that. It's not a friendly experience. So I was debating on whether I should crawl in there and get it because it looked modern. But I decided, sometimes these are good, too, just for educational collections at the museum. So
you almost just passed it by.
Yep, definitely. I was like debating on whether I really wanted to fight all these thorns to get to it. But I saw it in there, and it looked in really good condition. So I got in there, got closer, and I'm like, this does look like it's fossilized. And, dug it out and got a GPS location documented where it was found. And then came back to the camp, showed it, and they're like, this looks interesting. This might be something new. We're not sure. This isn't our, area of expertise, so we'll need to get somebody to look at it. So,
now, of course, you were talking earlier about finding a humanoid skeleton in this area, and we've worked very hard to try to fill in the holes in figuring out our ancestry as human beings. Now, with foxes, I would guess that there are probably a lot of holes.
Definitely. They're not the fossils that get you a lot of money or funding. Typically, it's usually dinosaurs or primates are very hot items to get money on there. But yeah, they're filling it out because fortunately, usually people don't. They always refer to high grade like fossil quarries or areas like this where they only pick up the ones of interest. That to them, they'll usually try to collect everything. So if somebody else is interested in studying foxes, they'll have them in the collection and be able to study those. But they're definitely sussing out the whole fox family tree here. So,
all right. Well, and this skull looks very similar to a modern fox's. And you knew it was a fossil, but how did you know that it was an ancient fox?
By the unit that it was found in, and then the units were about 4 million years, and then just looking at the condition of the bone material, that you could tell that the actual calcium in the bones had been replaced by other minerals or remineralized. So you could tell that it had been fossilized.
And from looking at the structure and studying the structure, how does it differ from a modern fox?
It's a little bit bigger, and it has a more narrow muzzle, and the teeth, most of the differences kind of come down in the teeth, how the cusps are. So probably was pursuing a different diet than some of the more other foxes today. So,
and would it have looked pretty similar, do you think?
I think so. Probably if you saw a red fox, you'd probably guess this as you at first glance, you probably wouldn't really notice a difference between them. So,
in having this fossil and identifying the species, what can we learn about modern day foxes and the fossil record from this particular find?
Probably a lot of it, just the whole evolution of foxes, how they're adapting to their environment and different, you know, sources of food along the way. That's probably the biggest thing. And then also that tells us a little bit about our own history, about the environment that, you know, early hominids were adapting to or dealing with that, you know, 4 million years ago. So it just kind of tells you the whole backstory of what all the animals were dealing with in that environment.
Well, it's interesting to think about, you know, in 4 million years, hominids changed a lot and foxes didn't change very much. So what does that tell us?
I'd say, you know, kind of evolution, you sometimes things get right fairly quickly and, you know, get a good niche that niche isn't taken away from them or they aren't forced to expand onto another area on there. That's just, you look at other animals today, like crocodiles and things like that, where, you know, they're for 100 million years or more, they haven't really changed or changed that much. You know, there are very little evolutionary changes that you see. So it seems like sometimes things get it, you know, fairly quickly off the bat that they get a good niche in their environment and they adapt very well to it. And fortunately for them, their environment doesn't get toppled over or turned upside down completely, that they have to strike out in a new direction.
So the foxes got it right early on.
I think so. Yeah, when you look at foxes, they're pretty smart and pretty adaptive to a multitude of situations to, you know, get food and survive.
I'm talking with Iowa State University geologist Mark Matheson. 12 years ago, he uncovered the fossil of an ancient fox, and now the species has been named after him. It is Vulpes Mathesoni, or Matheson's fox. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about more of his research into a number of other fossils as well. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me, Iowa State University geologist Mark Matheson. 12 years ago, he uncovered a fossil of an ancient fox in Ethiopia. Now the species has been named after him. And Mark, before the break, we were talking about what we can learn from this fossil. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that this took 12 years from your finding it to have to the point of having the species named. You thought perhaps that this fossil was just going to be in a cardboard box getting dusty for the next 100 years or so. Now, tell me why this wasn't something that you could bring home with you and research, since you were the guy who found it.
Part of this is with a lot of the countries in Africa, they went through a lot of colonial periods where, you know, Eastern European powers came in and kind of took what they wanted and, you know, didn't really leave much behind or kind of, and this was true with fossils too, that they were all moved out of country, you know, to European museums and that, and not, you know, nothing was left in country. And actually Richard Leakey came in and said, hey, this isn't right, with when he was finding fossils. And he basically, with Kenya and Ethiopia, got them to pass laws saying that fossils found in the country have to stay in the country to try to preserve their heritage in the country, that it's not all just being wholesale, you know, taken away and that, you know, they're left with nothing. So with Ethiopia, all fossils found there have to stay there, and they don't even let you borrow them to study them. So they're trying to preserve their heritage inside country. And then with that, you know, it gets with some of the fossils, it's a little bit difficult to get somebody who's more of an expert in these areas to actually have to go to Addis Ababa to look at the fossils, bring their equipment, and study them. You know, getting the logistics to get somebody over there and actually, you know, you're saying, oh, it might be something new, but we don't know for sure. So, you know, taking the risk to spend, you know, maybe several thousand dollars to fly over there, where you might get a good paper out of this, but then again, you might be bust on there. But I think that's most of it, just being able to get people to the fossils is the the difficult part. So.
Well, and I can imagine Ethiopia is not a country that has always been a very stable country. And even when you were there, there were a lot of young men walking around carrying Kalashnikov rifles. Was it did you feel like it was a dangerous place to be?
At times, you know, it's you kind of got used to it because, you know, every kid who's, you know, 12 and older and male, you know, has a AK-47. So it's just somewhat commonplace. But, you know, it still worries you a little bit when somebody comes up to you and says, suka, 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 which is candy in their language. And you're like, well, if I don't give them candy or I don't have candy, does that mean I'm going to get shot? Yeah. But, you know, for the most part, they understood that, you know, they kind of leave foreigners alone. And also we did have one policeman with us at that time, but they know that they shouldn't mess with these people. Otherwise, the government, the Ethiopian army gets involved and gets into a very messy situation. But you're kind of out in the equivalent of somewhat the Wild West, and you have a number of different tribes. Even with us, we had the Bume and the Mersey on either side of the rivers of the River Omo that didn't get along necessarily. And near the end of our expedition, they actually the Bume kids went over to try to steal cattle from the Mersey, and the Mersey started to shoot over at our campsite across the river. So that was a day out before we were going to leave. So we just decided, it's a good time to leave then. It's kind of
a good indicator that it's time to get going. As a tall white guy in Ethiopia, you attracted a lot of attention too, didn't you?
Oh, definitely. There was no hiding on just given the whole situation there. But when we go down to the river, you know, to kind of get cleaned up, everybody was like, oh, okay. Is everybody the same, you know, built the same on this? So they're always trying to catch a glimpse of what you really looked like.
So when you're taking a bath, basically,
yes.
They're
trying to see, because for them, you know, it's with the temperatures and the humidity, you know, you're very scantily clad or with clothing or not at all. And, you know, not the typical Western side where we're fairly well covered. So they're always kind of curious, are you the same as us or, you know, on that?
Right, just a little bit of scientific research
You're
taking your bath.
We didn't know who was the scientist at that point.
Right.
So, yeah, definitely. But it was, you know, it was kind of an interesting experience. You go down there, you got crocodiles in the river with you, and then the fish love the soap that you're using. They're trying to eat it out of your hands as you're kind of trying to get cleaned up, and then it's like the circus came to town. Everybody's like watching you on this. But at other times, it got a little more interesting too, that since they're kind of, you know, still they'll engage in tribal warfare, and some of the people there, they kind of see that they're the, you know, I guess, say the macho warrior dude of the village, and they'd come up to me and, you know, kind of like be telling me this, that they're the ultimate warrior of their village, and, you know, posturing with me to try to say, hey, you know, it's like I'm stronger than you. But I was just like, okay, that's you have the machine gun, that's, I'm happy with that. So
you win by default.
Exactly.
So as a geologist, how do you decide where you will go on an expedition? For example, and we'll talk about some of the other expeditions you've gone on as well, but what led you to Ethiopia?
I had done a number of field seasons in Egypt looking for early primates. More, they'd be equivalent to lemurs on there. But John Flegel, the guy who led the expedition in Ethiopia, he had done a number of seasons there. That's where I'd met him. And a lot of times with this, if they find somebody that's a good field hand, that you have good technical skills, you can drive a manual transmission, fix things, and, you know, be able to do a number of various tasks to enable science, you're kind of sought after at that. And especially if you're good at finding fossils or have a, you know, be able to find the order and the chaos when you're looking through sand or dirt to actually pick out those fossils or those needles on the proverbial haystack.
Now, of course, we all know that there are places in the world that have been the site of many fossil finds. There seem to be sort of fossil hotspots at different places all over the globe. What are some of the signs that an area would be rich in fossils?
Definitely, a lot of it, it's the current modern day environment helps out considerably, because it's not the typical image where you see somebody going out and, you know, divining and saying, oh, we should dig here, I know there's fossils here. It's nothing like that. It's a lot of it just walking and just doing basic reconnaissance to find these. The biggest thing you're looking for is like a high erosion area, like any kind of more desert environment where you don't have a lot of vegetation and the ground's eroding away. That's like even in the Bighorn Mountains or out in Wyoming or the West, it's a great environment there to find fossils just because it's so arid and you have these high erosion areas. So nature is doing all the work to uncover these fossils out of the units, and you're basically just hoping to get there at the right time to see it as it's just getting revealed and be able to find those hot spots where fossils are concentrated. Sometimes you can kind of read the land a little bit, or identifying like ancient streams that, you know, where there might be a good concentration of fossils from that. But a lot of it, you're just targeting the high erosion areas to say that, okay, the material's been removed there and I can hit that, you know, and hopefully find fossils there that have been already revealed by nature and get them before they get destroyed. So usually, yep. Oh, go ahead.
Of course, in Iowa, we've had a couple of major flooding events in 93 and 2008. And in Johnson County, there's a fossil gorge that was uncovered because of this tremendous flooding. Is that something that geologists can use? Do you follow natural disasters?
Potentially on that. A lot of times, you know, you don't necessarily look for it, but if you have like a big flooding event that's, you know, down cutting or removing a lot of material, you'd basically, you know, you say it couldn't hurt to go down there and look for fossils, but a lot of times, you know, when you just local people tend to find the fossils, you know, they're first there and they notice it and report it, and then you're like, oh, you know, we probably should go take a look at that. So.
Well, let's talk about some of the other excursions you've been on. You've been to Mongolia. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was with Carl Vonder, another professor at Iowa State. We kind of got on with a group that was a little more geotourism on there, but it was looking for going to a lot of the dinosaur sites and helping collect dinosaurs in Mongolia, which is kind of the birthplace of a lot of the fossils, you know, from Jurassic Park, the Velociraptors. That's where they're found, and the Protoceratops. But just a beautiful place with a rich cultural heritage there. Just an amazing place to visit, but not easy to get to. So.
And geological tourism, I guess that's probably not something that a lot of us are actually familiar with. So is that common where people can kind of buy their way onto expeditions so that they can have this kind of experience?
Yes, it's getting more common. There's even with Iowa State, we have a field camp in Wyoming, but we see a lot of professional collectors on dinosaurs actually have digs going in. You know, basically people can pay to participate and help unearth dinosaurs and dig them out and collect them. But it's getting more popular on this, especially, you know, maybe in more of the exotic areas to, you know, to go in and, you know, participate in, you know, this wonderful experience of uncovering history on seeing something that's nobody's ever seen before. It's like being the first person to, you know, actually, you know, touch something that's, you know, millions of years old is kind of a special feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked in thinking about Mongolia, thinking about Ethiopia, those are pretty remote areas, but you've also been to places that are much more highly populated, like in Norway, for example. Where were you in Norway and what were you looking for?
That was kind of transposing a little bit on there. Geology is a study of the Earth, so you really have to travel the Earth to understand the Earth. It's been very fortunate to be able to participate in this, but Neil Iverson, another professor at Iowa State, had a field season near Glomfjord, Norway, and we were actually at the Engelbrand Glacier, and it's just this beautiful glacier that the ice is so blue that it almost looks black, but the Norwegians had tunneled underneath it to collect meltwater for hydroelectric power, but they also had put a lab underneath the glacier so you could actually get to the bottom of the glacier, and we were putting in instrumentation to study the movement of the glacier, whether it's, you know, kind of ice, like if you, you know, squeeze it really hard, it'll deform like putty. But sometimes they're thinking the glaciers, instead of moving that way, they might actually have these little slip events where they kind of jerk along. But we were trying to tease out what the mechanism was of the glacier movement. It's the only place in the world where you can get access to the bottom of a glacier and have literally, you come in through a doorway, melt your way in with these large fire hoses, spraying hot water to melt a cavity. But at the same rate, you're standing in there and you have 600 feet of ice above your head. And at the same time as you're melting it, once you stop melting, the room or cavity you create is shrinking by about half each day, just as ice kind of tries to heal the cavity that you've created. So.
You know, I know a lot of students get excited about the idea of archaeology or paleontology or geology because they think they are going to go on excursions and expeditions all the time and live like Indiana Jones. And we've been talking about some of the very exciting events in your career. Tell me about the balance. I mean, how much time do you spend in the field and how much time do you spend in the lab?
Usually you're spending more time in the lab than you are actually out in the field, and even that short period of time you're spending in the field, you're typically collecting so many fossils that you can't possibly look at all of them in a timely fashion or in a year or more. You kind of have to prioritize which ones you want to look at that point. But it gets to be an interesting balance because you want to collect the fossils before they get destroyed just sitting out and being exposed to the environment to try to preserve them. But then again, it's like you're kind of outpacing yourself on how fast you can actually do the science on them. So
when you found this box fossil that we started talking about at the beginning, you weren't out there looking for ancient fox fossils. When you are out in the field, do you have to just keep your mind open and look for things that might be unexpected that aren't on the list of things you were sent to find?
Oh, definitely. You try to be very observant and just look for anything that is like out of order, that doesn't seem like it belongs there. It's a part of the natural stratigraphic units or rocks that should be there. You're kind of just always trying to see something if something stands out, look for any differences or if something's too continuous, you kind of look and say there might be something different on there that I'm not, you know, paying attention to. But always you're trying to give everything the once over, you know, twice, you know, on there just to make sure you're not passing something up. And even for looking for fossils, a number of people said they actually liked bigger people because they didn't like to walk. You know, they wouldn't walk so much because a lot of times, especially trying to find fossils that are the teeth might be the size of a large sand grain, you know, you have to sit down. So they really want you to like sit down in an area and actually look closely at the ground, you know, just to see what might be there. And that's happened to me a number of times. I'm not finding anything, but I just sat down and started looking around, and all of a sudden I see this wealth that, you know, standing up, I had no idea was even there. So.
Oh, fascinating. Well, I'm sure this fox probably makes the Ethiopian excursion stand out for you. But if you think about highlights and maybe your favorite expedition ever, is there one that stands out?
Well, definitely this one. It stands out for a number of reasons, just with the cultural, you know, driving 4 days to the field and that. But I've had a number of rewarding experiences too in Egypt with a number of field seasons there. But the doing field work there was, if you rate it as a 1 to 10 on like how easy or nice or plush it is, I would be pretty much a 10 because they'd have workers to help you clear away material. The tents are set up. They had, you know, a cook and everything like that. And then just the, you know, interacting with the people of Egypt was just really great. They're just fun, loving people that, you know, will laugh about anything. They're just very happy people. So that was always a great experience. And then also with the number of the other older professors who would be out there that, you know, were always students of history, you know, read Herodotus. And in the evenings, you just soak in all this knowledge of their stories, of their life events, and then also what they've read in history. So just an amazing experience there on just so many different levels of the fossils being in Egypt for seeing all the antiquities and the sites there, and then also being, you know, picking up all this other extra information in the evenings. So it's just, you know, you're really completely disconnected from the grid or the network and, you know, learning things just in a very truistic way. So.
And where will you go next?
Probably the next thing that I'd be doing in the field at this point would be going back out to Wyoming to our Iowa State Geology Field Station. We take students out there for our geology students for 6 weeks and teach them field methods, give them, you know, immersion. Like it would be equivalent to learning a foreign language in the country, but we're teaching them geology and basically the language of geology in the field. So.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Mark Matheson is a geologist at Iowa State University. He's just had a species of ancient fox named after him, Vulpes Mathesoni. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Jane Chu. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.